Welcome to Oncology Today, a special edition focused on key presentations in gastrointestinal cancers from the 2023 ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Philip Phillip from the Wayne State University and Henry Ford Cancer Institute in Detroit, Michigan. In addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. Phillip's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him about his current approach to the use of cell-free DNA assays in the management of colon cancer.
In the adjuvant setting, in our institution, we have been using it, yes, including myself. There are two types of assays, as you know. So we have been using the informed assay, believing that it is probably more sensitive and more informative, as the name implies. We are using it in patients who have... When we have patients in multiple situations, one is if you have someone who has stage 2 colon cancer, or someone who's older and has stage 3 colon cancer, and you're really not sure which direction to go. You know that, Neil. There's always this discussion of the stage 2. So this would be a good one, really, to resolve that, because if you do it and it's positive, then... you know the CEA is not going to help you there. So it would be, if it's positive, then you really... are in trouble, kind of. and if you have someone who has stage 3 disease, and the patient is a 68-year-old with heart problems and other things, and the patient has, T3N1 disease, and you want to forego adjuvant treatment, then that's another example of someone who will benefit from this if the patient has negative. And you can even expand that further into the older patients, and where there's always a question of shall we treat the patient or not. So that would be another way of doing that. I'm just going to jump forward to metastatic disease. Patients who get, for example, immunotherapy, sometimes it's difficult to judge what's the activity of the disease. As you know, we can see patients whose CA can go even the wrong direction, and we don't know if they're progressing, or even the tumor gets a bit bigger and we don't know. So in those situations, I found that it can be helpful with immunotherapy, the sequential treatment. One has to also keep in mind that there are areas, situations where you're not going to necessarily be getting an accurate read when you have, for example, predominant peritoneal disease. The peritoneal metastases don't shed enough of the DNA, so you can get false negatives also. So that's another thing to keep in mind. I personally think that to give a blanket statement that everyone should be getting it may be a bit overambitious, but certainly increasingly we're finding ways of trying to use them in certain situations, and I gave you examples of what I use myself. Resection of the liver metastases, and that will be another area, because resecting liver metastases, there is no strong evidence that giving additional treatment additions. So let's say you gave chemotherapy beforehand, you resected, and then you did the resection. There's really no good data that you need more treatment, and if you do the ctDNA is positive, then you may consider either the same treatment, more of it, or changing the systemic treatment to something different, because you're dealing with metastatic disease, so you have the luxury of having multiple options in your menu. Unlike strict adjuvant stage 2 or 3, you're limited to only one or two regimens.
You know, another thing is I always see these stories through the eyes of the general medical oncologist who takes care of everything, and when I hear all the talk about Signatera, I know it may seem kind of strange, but one of the things I think a lot about is Oncotype and how assays like Oncotype developed in breast cancer. Because before that, there were a million assays or ways to predict prognosis. But the thing that was different about Oncotype was that they showed there was a relationship between the treatment effect and in a sense, that's kind of looks to me like what they're trying to do with cell-free DNA. It's not good enough to say, okay, you've got a positive assay, you're likely to relapse or progress, but will intervention change that outcome? And the other area that I kind of wonder about is using less chemotherapy, which again, can happen with Oncotype. So right now, it looks like, you know, the data looks good and node negative. What do you think about the idea of de-escalating therapy in node positive? You know, one positive node, for example, with a negative Signatera. Do you think that the trials looking at that may eventually show that, you know, maybe it's not, you don't need to treat them?
Exactly. And that really ties in somehow with what I said. If you have someone who has negative and has one lymph node or two lymph nodes in the N1, do you really even need the treatment? That becomes even more into that aspect of it. They really need the treatment. And by the way, the study that was done, the Galaxy really suggested that patients who have positive, they can benefit from adjuvant treatment, but that needs to be confirmed. Right. And those are the studies that are currently being done. You asked me about other trials. I think we are probably, we'll be in a good shape in the next 3 to 4 years in terms of having some much clearer. And certainly you're right. I mean, de-escalation or even removal. I mean, you don't need to use the treatment in some patients.
So one other situation I've heard people talk about using cell-free DNA, and I don't know how often you run into this, but I hear a lot of cases from the community of people with MSI-high metastatic disease who do really well, and they get out a year or two, and you start thinking about, you know, stopping therapy. How often do you run into that situation? Do you think that's something where cell-free DNA would be helpful?
Yes, I mean, I have, I can remember a patient who actively is under my care now, an older guy, and using the ctDNA, and this patient also started to run into some problems with the autoimmune reactions, arthritis and all that, and the ctDNA consistently coming back as normal, which really helps me to decide to more comfortably to discontinue the treatment, and we can continue doing the ctDNA. If it goes up, we can go back to it. So that's again, it's part of what we're talking about, using it as a tool in patients where we can even stop treatment and watch the patient. I don't see any harm in doing that. I'm comfortable with that in patients who radiologically are very stable, nothing is happening, and the ctDNA comes down to normal. Do I really want to continue forever with a treatment on that? And I'm doing that in my patients, but I'm also somehow influenced by how they're reacting to the treatment. When they have side effects, my threshold is very low to just give them a break. They like it.
So you also mentioned some more data that came out from the PARADIGM study and the whole issue of first-line therapy of metastatic colorectal cancer, something that's been debated for a long time. I'm curious, again, right now in your practice, how you approach first-line therapy in terms of choice of biologic, and particularly in what situations, if any, are you using EGFR antibody first-line?
So in patients obviously who have right-sided colon cancers, I'm still using bevacizumab in combination with either FOLFOX, CAPOX, very infrequently FOLFIRI, or FOLFIRINOX, FOLFOXIRI if I see a patient with higher risk and younger and fit. On the left side colon tumors, I use the combination of FOLFOX and panitumumab myself. I've been using it for a while because of the data we have, and also the study that came from Japan, which I talked about, that clearly shows that there is a benefit and patients do better. Some people argue that you will get a rash for a year. I don't see the rash that much, but then again, someone else now listening to this in Nashville will be saying something different, because I don't live in that area. I work in Midwest. I'm in Detroit, but I haven't really had the problems with the rash, and I'm very proactive for many years. I start with antibiotics from day minus one, and you know, we look at it very carefully. So I have been able to really navigate that without having too much of an issue.
Let me ask you, you just referred to the geography. I thought that really just applies mainly to infusion reactions. Do you also see worse dermatologic toxicity geographically?
No, I was referring to the immune reactions.
The infusion reaction.
And in fact, okay, immune, I was just trying to just mention it that
right.
In terms of the reactions.
Yeah, because you have an extra problem there. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. So you also talked about data following up the Mountaineer study that really had such an impact on practice, the look using tucatinib and trastuzumab, and also the DESTINY trials looking at TDXD, both in HER2-positive disease. Can you comment a little bit about HER2 testing, though, in colorectal cancer? One of the things that you brought up in your talk that I hadn't thought about was the fact that you can't pick up amplification on NGS. But can you just provide an overview of HER2-positive colorectal cancer, how often you see it, and how you think about utilizing, TDXD is currently not approved, I believe, in CRC, although I don't know why. It seems like the data even more came out at ASCO. But I'm curious, assuming that you can potentially even access it now, but assuming you had access to both strategies, tucatinib, trastuzumab, the Mountaineer approach, as well as the TDXD approach, how do you think about sequencing them, and what experience do you have with those two approaches?
So in terms of the prevalence of the HER2 you asked me about, it's like up to 5% of the patients have it. And as I mentioned earlier, it is enriched in patients who have RAS wild type and also BRAF RAS wild type, and also enriched in patients who have left-sided tumors. So that's as far as I can tell you from the epidemiology of the or the frequency. In terms of sequencing, I have not used it in frontline treatment, so it's going to be second line and beyond. And the reason why I say second line is that there is also evidence that that HER2 positivity it also predicts for lesser response to treatment with anti-EGFR treatment. So the question becomes, if you have someone going into second line treatment, do you really want to try EGFR targeting first and then do? The short answer is I prefer not to. And for that reason, I always have my molecular data. I work on it even from the day I see a patient, a new patient with stage 4 disease or recurrent patient. I always have that so that I know how I'm going to really look at the patient longitudinally. So when I come to second line, I will be thinking of HER2 treatment. This is the way I look at it for the reasons I gave you. At this point in time, tucatinib is and trastuzumab is FDA approved, and I think it makes sense to use it at that point in the second line. And in those patients in the third line or fourth line, I would still consider using the deruxtecan. And I'll give you another reason for that. When you're thinking of tucatinib and trastuzumab, you're thinking of inhibiting a signaling pathway more than anything else, because that's what you're doing. You're using non-chemotherapy, non-cytotoxic treatment. Obviously, it kills some cancer cells. I'm not saying it's benign, but that's the way it works, by inhibiting the signaling. When you think of deruxtecan, it's a bit different, because there you're thinking of a molecule which is one portion trastuzumab, eight portions of cytotoxic drug, which is bound to it, payload. So really, in some ways, you may not be thinking of pure signaling inhibitor, but you're using the HER2 as a way of delivering a cytotoxic payload to the cancer cell. So for that reason, if you treat someone with tucatinib and trastuzumab and they get resistant, it may be that they're resistant because of some alternate pathways of overcoming that, but they may still be susceptible to being killed by a payload given through the HER2.
So you just convinced me that there ought to be a trial looking at tucatinib, trastuzumab plus TDXD. Is there a trial looking at that?
I haven't heard of one, but it could be someone is doing a small trial somewhere. But I don't know if there's a large, like, prospective trial being done in the way we think of trials.
I haven't heard about it, but that doesn't mean that it's not happening. In terms of TDXD, of course, one of the issues there, it's obviously used in breast cancer, lung cancer, upper GI cancers, and you commented on it a little bit, was the issue of interstitial lung disease. And it kind of, of course, breast cancer has a lead on everybody else. And in breast cancer, it seemed like the earlier you use it, the less ILD you see. Another thing that you see at breast cancer is they're very aggressive about looking for it on imaging. They do, you know, CT of the chest in asymptomatic patients, for example. How do you view that issue and that risk in patients with colorectal cancer and, for that matter, upper GI cancer?
Yeah, I personally, I mean, in majority of the time when you do scans anyway, every 2 months, we do the whole body scan. So it's very unusual for us to not include the chest, although we could not include the chest, but we do as a habit. And I think with the use of these drugs, we will just do an additional chest CT. So that's all we do, basically. So that will be the way to look for it. I don't know the more aggressive way of doing it. I mean, we're not doing anything more than that. At least I'm not doing anything more than that.
Yeah, no, that's similar. That's very similar to what they're doing in breast.
And am I convinced that in colorectal or upper GI, it's going to be the same? Like later you use it, you get more of the ILD. I'm not 100% convinced on that. But again, we need to wait for real-world data, which hopefully will help us.
Have you used the Mountaineer approach? And I'm curious what you see in terms of toxicity and quality of life in these patients.
The quality of life is fairly well preserved. I really haven't seen anything more than what to expect. I mean, obviously there is you can get a bit of the fatigue and all that, but nothing really which strikes out at being non-manageable in my opinion. So
another data set you talked about was the sunlight data, looking at TAS 102 plus Bev. That's been out there for a while. I'm curious when you employ that in your practice, and the age-old question of what comes first, regorafenib or a TAS 102 with Bev.
So with the information we have, I personally nowadays use the TAS 102 and the bevacizumab earlier than regorafenib. And again, do I have a good reason for that? The TAS 102 plus bevacizumab was a study that was a comparison against TAS 102. And the regorafenib was versus a placebo. Is that a reason for me or anyone to prefer one over the other? Maybe yes, maybe not. The other reason that is the main reason that people like myself were a bit concerned about the regorafenib was when we used it, we saw the side effects, and you know, you're aware of them. But since then, I also started using, when I use it, I use 80 milligram. I start with 80, I build it up. Sometimes I even start with 120. I don't do 160 on any patient. Having said that, recently I have been using more of the TAS 102 plus bevacizumab earlier than later. In other words, earlier than regorafenib. But I'm not discounting regorafenib. Still, I think it's a drug that we can use, and it has activity. But the question becomes, with the fruquintinib, where do you place regorafenib if fruquintinib becomes available for us for use?
And you also talked about some of the fruquintinib data presented at ASCO. What's your take? It sounds sort of like regorafenib. What's your take on it in terms of efficacy and side effects compared to regorafenib, or for that matter, TAS 102?
So the side effects included hypertension, asthenia, and the Hand-Foot syndrome, which pretty much is a class effect similar to regorafenib. The issue is whether it's a more potent VEGFR1/2/3 inhibitor. Maybe that makes it more has better anti-tumor activity. Again, it's really difficult to say. Again, it was a comparison against placebo. It wasn't against regorafenib. It is an option, and sometimes with these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, you never know. I mean, it may be that if you use regorafenib, patient fails, you go to fruquintinib or vice versa. We've seen those things happening, so having another drug won't hurt.
So you also talked about some more data of following up the use of zolbetuximab in gastric cancer. Can you talk a little bit about right now what your current approach is to the management of gastroesophageal cancers? And do you think that zolbetuximab is going to be approved? And if it is, how do you think, how would you integrate it into your practice?
So my current algorithm starts with testing for a couple of key biomarkers, which include HER2, as you know, and also microsatellite instability. Those really get me into the initial entry into the plan of a patient. Certainly, if they have HER2, then I go for the combination chemotherapy plus plus trastuzumab plus pembro. That's been our standard for a few years now. In those patients in the second line, I will go for paclitaxel and ramucirumab. But again, in those patients, one may also have to have an open mind into maybe not so much second line, but the third line. Do you really go back into using an anti-HER2 treatment? And these are situations, Neil, where we have to really train ourselves to start using the molecular, serial molecular testing to really direct where we go. Could be another biopsy, or it could be another ctDNA testing to look for the HER2. In patients who do not have HER2 overexpression, then my standard of care will be a doublet of oxali and fluoropyrimidine plus nivolumab, although I don't think that pembrolizumab would be giving a different thing at this point. But we've started off with nivolumab. That's what I use. And that would be the way I will, if I give the treatment, I would go for 6 months of therapy maybe, if I can do up to that point, and then I put them on the nivolumab on its own as a maintenance treatment until they have disease progression. And that would be, now there is a study that's going to be open nationally looking at the doublet, FOLFOX or CAPOX versus FOLFIRINOX. The question would be whether if you upgrade your chemo to FOLFIRINOX and with the immunotherapy, you'll get a better outcome. That study is not open yet, but it's approved by CTEP to go ahead, I think, within the next few months or something like that. So that would be my approach. In patients who have MSI high, as you know, there will be, again, a small number of patients. Those patients, I would probably go for chemotherapy plus an anti-IO. Now, do I know which chemotherapy works best, or do I really think that do I need the IO or I don't need the IO? That's a question unresolved. It's unlike colorectal cancer where we have some good data on that, KEYNOTE-177. So back to your question about the Claudin. I think the Claudin will really, in my opinion, I see this becoming another option for us in the frontline setting with a couple of caveats. One of them is that we need to have a reliable test. We need to have a test approved. I think that's what's going to happen. You need a test approved by the FDA or a CLIA-approved test. But the second question becomes, in patients who are HER2 negative and Claudin 18.2 positive, what is the role of the immunotherapy here? Are we going to also add immunotherapy or ignore immunotherapy? There will be some patients who would like to give them immunotherapy, certainly CPS 10 or more, or even 5 or more. So this is going to be, I think, the next area of not only discussion, but hoping that there will be some quick trials to try to help us to understand that aspect, if these trials are not really planned yet.
Any experience with zolbetuximab? One of the things I've been hearing about, and I think you maybe mentioned it, there are GI toxicities, but seems to be sort of an on-target effect. Have you actually used the agent?
I don't have. We were part of a study, but part of a study in pancreatic, not in, in upper GI. So I don't have really a good experience personal, but it's consistent that we hear about across different studies the upper GI symptoms. You're right. And also the appetite issue.
Right. I think dysgeusia, I'm not sure if they've seen that as well.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about hepatobiliary cancers. And you presented some follow-up data from the EMBRAVE adjuvant trial of HCC looking at atezo-bev. I'm curious what your thoughts are about the data right now. They just have a progression-free survival benefit. From the, looking at the data, is that something that you'd like to use or you have used?
So the primary endpoint was relapse-free survival, looked at independently. And certainly there is a nice separation there. So in my opinion, in patients who still have a, especially the high-risk patients, still have a significant risk of relapse, I would use it. I've used it. I mean, we, in our institution where we have a large liver program, we started using it in the adjuvant setting, yes. And we're used to the side effects. I mean, obviously, we're used to the side effects, how to manage the combination from use in the advanced disease. And the same thing. I mean, if you have patients, you can't give it to them. Here, the issue of the esophageal variceal bleeding will be less of an issue, but still, there will be patients who you cannot give because of the immunotherapy. They cannot take it because of autoimmune conditions.
So I'm kind of curious, in these patients where you're thinking, or, you know, adjuvant therapy, where they've been treated with surgery for cure, whether it's surgical resection or transplant. Of course, transplant, they're not going to get an IO. But I'm curious, what fraction of these patients are cured just by the local therapy, roughly?
The fraction that is cured by local therapy, when you say local therapy, you're talking about resection or ablation. So surgery or ablation. You're not talking about transplant. The resection, the cure rate in those patients is around just under 20%. It's a low, but again, you have to relate it to also to a number of factors. This is not really that simple because you have to relate it to, apart from the size of the tumor, also the other factors like Charles Pugh and all that. So, but it's up to 20%. You can, if you have well selected patients, you can have a cure rate of around that number.
So another data set that you commented on was from the Himalaya study, the first-line trial looking at tremelimumab and durvalumab, anti-PD-1, and anti-CTLA-4. Of course, another option that came out after atezo-bev. You were talking about some data they presented on correlation with immune side effects. But I'm curious right now how you approach decision between the two. We actually did a webinar last night. We had Dr. Abu Alfa on, and he was, of course, very pro Dervatremi. I don't know if anybody else out there is as quite as pro as he is, but I'm curious how you think it through, and are you using Dervatremi first line, and if so, in what situations?
In my algorithm, I use it. So, I mean, as you know, it's more than the two. There is also the third option, which is to use one of the TKIs like sorafenib or lenvatinib. So that you have the three options. Certainly, in patients who can get the combination of atezo-bev, in our practice here, that's the first thing we look at. That would be our immediate plan to start the treatment. In patients who cannot take the bevacizumab for any reason, those will be the patients who would go for the other option, which is the Himalaya. And in patients who can't take either of them, certainly it will be the lenvatinib. I mean, everyone knows there's no head-to-head comparison between the two, but I don't have a strong reason to prefer Himalaya over the atezo-bev at this point in time, unless something else shows up later on.
One of the things we were talking about last night is the immune toxicity with Dervatremi, and I feel like a lot of people think about ipi-nivo when they think about that, but yet it only has one dose of Tremi, and it looks, from what I see indirectly, like a much less immune toxicity. Globally, when you think about, toxicity, particularly autoimmune toxicity, atezo-bev versus Dervatremi, do you think that Dervatremi has more autoimmune toxicity or maybe similar?
Compared to atezo-bev?
Yeah.
I think it has more, but it's not really like, as you exactly as you said, it's not like the Epinevo kind of story. The reason why I also like Atezo-Bev, because Atezo is a different mechanism of action, which is anti-VEGF. And as you know, many of those tumors can be hypervascular. That's how we see them on a scan. So I like to use an immunotherapy. And there is evidence that anti-VEGF treatments can have some kind of cooperation with other IOs. So, but the bottom line is that I, with the data itself, I'm not convinced that the Himalaya looks better than Atezo-Bev. I mean, I don't have that kind of, unless I'm reading it differently.
So you mentioned three first-line options, but another potential first-line option, I think, would be single-agent PD-1. I know it's not used very often, and the only time I hear people talking about it in older patients with a lot of comorbidities. You talked about the paper presented at ASCO on tislelizumab versus sorafenib. Any comments on that data set and also that strategy? Is that something that you think about?
Well, I mean, again, you can always look at durvalumab, which was an arm on the study right. with Himalaya. And it didn't, I mean, it was also decent compared to sorafenib. Certainly in patients who you cannot give a TKI, a single agent immunotherapy would be an option. And maybe I should have taken that into account and said there are four options. There's a single agent immunotherapy, IO. I fully agree with you. Although the way it was done is that not none of the major two studies looked into a single agent versus a TKI, and the other study, the tislelizumab, is not. I don't think the drug is available to us, or maybe it is. I'm not sure.
I don't think so. Not yet.
Yeah.
Any does that data look any different than what you've seen with durvalumab or other single agent IO?
I personally think it's very similar. I mean, in terms of the, if you look at the advantage of the drug to what you're doing with a single agent, is there an advantage over? The only thing is that I have to pronounce it correctly. The tislelizumab study was, as you know, it was a non-inferiority study. So you know that if you give if you don't give sorafenib or lenvatinib, and if you give the tislelizumab, it's a non-inferiority. So you know that it's going to be the same. So that by itself is a good assurance for you. But we need the drug.
I would assume that single-agent IO would be much more better tolerated than sorafenib.
It will be. It will be kind of easier once every 3 weeks IV instead of trying to remember taking pills. I mean, there are other things like hypertension, all the things you're avoiding that. Yeah, but you have to be careful with the other side effects that can happen, which luckily the severe side effects to immunotherapy, as you know, is less than 10%.
So a couple words about biliary tract cancers. You presented some follow-up data from the trial looking at first-line treatment with GemCis plus Pembro. We also saw a trial looking at chemo plus durvalumab. And again, I'm curious how you approach first-line therapy in these patients.
So the first-line treatment, I mentioned to you earlier, any patient I see stage four, I have to get the molecular makeup early on. Does it really affect me? It may. Like if I have a patient who comes to me with MSI high, I will certainly go for a combination. But these days doesn't matter because we're using either durvalumab or pembrolizumab in that situation. So the GemCis plus either of the two, at this time durvalumab, I've been using it for a long time, is my first line treatment. In the second line, depending on what I got from the molecular markers, it could be an IDH1 inhibitor, could be FGFR2 inhibitor, could be even HER2. I've had one patient, but that would be second line. If you look at the second line data, they're not really that great. I mean, there is benefit for FOLFOX, but if you look at the delta and the benefit, isn't that huge? I can always use it, the FOLFOX or the Aleri. There was a study in Nifty which had the ILA persona iron TK, and I can always use it maybe third line, but in the second line, I will definitely, in someone who has an opportunity, I will give them a targeted agent. So that would be pretty much my approach to the patients.
So you mentioned HER2, and again, you reviewed data looking at, first of all, what I call the mountaineer-type approach of trastuzumab to catinib, but also TDXD and biliary tract cancers. It looks like both of them have activity. What's your take of those? And again, how are you thinking about if and when to utilize them in your patients with biliary tract disease?
Yeah, I think it's a bit more difficult in biliary tract because we will not see that many patients to establish a good personal experience on sequencing. I think at this point in time, for me, it's availability. I don't know if I have access to the antibody, zanidatamab. In my patients, I would be using more the ducatinib if I can get access to it, or even the deruxtecan. Trastuzumab, depending on which one I can get access. It's a bit difficult for me to say how to prioritize which one.
So let's finish out talking about pancreatic cancer. And of course, we had the big phase 3 trial looking at NALIRIFOX, so sort of like FOLFIRINOX, except with NALIRI. From your point of view, what were some of the key findings in that study? And is that a strategy you'd like to utilize?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the superiority of the three drugs was there. The response rate was like over 40%, close to 42%, which was more than what we saw with the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, which is around 30%. So certainly, you see even a better objective response in that situation. The difference in the survival was there, as you know. But again, this combination did not show any benefit over the regular FOLFIRINOX, which is based on the French study. But things have changed over the years. We don't use the original FOLFIRINOX. When people use modified FOLFIRINOX, nowadays they're getting rid of the 5-FU. And then also they're using lower doses of the iron TCAN, could be 150 or 140 in the original FOLFIRINOX, which is higher. The question is, how does this NALIRIFOX fare against the modified FOLFIRINOX, both in terms of efficacy and also in terms of side effects? But the experience with the NALIRIFOX has shown that it's more tolerable than the regular full-dose FOLFIRINOX. As I said, from that perspective, it makes sense to use in patients who are a bit older, maybe performance status is a bit borderline, with patients where we never used the full FOLFIRINOX. And also, it may go into the earlier stage when we use it before surgery in those patients. But I think it's not improving the survival of the patients beyond what we already have. It may improve the tolerability and utility in older patients. That's as much as I can tell about this regimen, the NALIRIFOX.
So I know you may be there, as you mentioned, there's not a direct comparison, but what's your take on, first of all, the efficacy and tolerability of NALIRIFOX versus FOLFIRINOX as it's currently being used?
So I would say that in terms of the response rate, based on this phase 3 trial, it looks like the response rate you may get a better response rate. So that's one thing. Because with the FOLFIRINOX in this modified form, I don't think we're getting response rates up to 40%. That's my impression. So in terms of the response rate, we are seeing better response rates than the FOLFIRINOX, and certainly we're seeing a better response rate than the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, as you well know. In terms of the side effects, there is diarrhea, but in my opinion, the diarrhea the severe diarrhea is less than what is seen with the FOLFIRINOX. The fatigue, the way it's described, is less than what I'm what I've experienced with my patients who get modified FOLFIRINOX. The neutropenia, I think, is probably going to be comparable, maybe a bit less. But again, that's a dose effect, and with longer use of the modified FOLFIRINOX, we may decide that the neutropenia is maybe not that much different. The neuropathy is probably also an improvement of what we see on the FOLFIRINOX, largely because we're using a, or largely because we're able to use a lower dose of the oxaliplatin. There will not be a head-to-head comparison. I'm just giving you my what I read about the study in terms of the outcome and what I experience myself with the FOLFIRINOX in my daily life.
So can you kind of provide an overview of how you decide on first-line therapy now and whether or not that would change if NALIRIFOX were, if you could give it?
So at this point in time, the first-line treatment is very much dependent on patients, a number of things. One of them is patient's age. There are patients who I will, over the age of 75, my use of triplet, let's call it triplet, it will be much, much, much less. In patients who have a borderline performance status, like they're two and a half, obviously I won't use it. Patients who have 1.5 or 1.75, then I will use the triplet, provided they're not that old, obviously. And the other thing would be the issue of the liver function, because if they have a bilirubin that's elevated, it's not good for irinotecan. It's also not good for nab-paclitaxel, as a matter of fact. So these are the major things. And the fourth one, which is also an important one, is when I talk to the patient. That to me is also very important. And the issue of the triplet that always requires a port, and the doublet that I might even be able to start without the port. So these are things that really, make a decision on what you're really wanting to do. And the fifth factor is that if you want to put them on a clinical trial frontline, as you know, some clinical trials are combinations with one, like a triplet. The other one may be a combination with the doublet. So there are a number of factors that really go into this. If I'm expecting someone to start chemotherapy and maybe for some reason, like locally advanced, unresectable, then I think that there's a possibility of resection, then obviously it's a triplet. But here, your question is about metastatic disease. So this will be really very much my the way I do it. Now, your other question is if NALIRIFOX is available, would I use it? And if it's on my formulary, I would use it because I would like to gain experience with it. Because I still think that the mechanism of action of the liposomal irinotecan and the ability to reduce the dose of the oxaliplatin is attractive, because the longer term treatment of patients, maybe the side effects will be, even if they have progression of disease and they leave the triplet treatment, if they have less of the neuropathy and other things, it might allow them additional treatments without being bothered much. But if they leave a treatment and they have significant neuropathy, then the second line treatments will be difficult. So if I can see that thing happening, that would be a plus for the NALIRIFOX.
So what about when you use a triplet in the neoadjuvant setting? Any preference?
So in the neoadjuvant setting, I think it will be the same principles we're talking about. Usually, in the neoadjuvant setting, by definition, patients are a bit younger. So you're talking about triplet more than a doublet. In fact, most people will never think of using a doublet in the neoadjuvant setting, so it's a triplet. And it will be the same thing in terms of patients getting them through the treatment. In the neoadjuvant setting, it's very important for them to get treatment, enough exposure, because they are potentially curable. So the quality of life and all these things become even more important. When you're treating metastatic disease, you may drop one of the drugs, you may do things for the quality of life, but in the neoadjuvant setting, the quality of life will be much more of an issue than metastatic disease. And in fact, if you look at the studies that do adjuvant therapy, one of the downside of adjuvant therapy in this disease is that you can't complete more than 50% in a fair number of patients. And that's the concern with the current treatments. But if you have a treatment that is more friendly with quality of life, it's very important because these patients are potentially curable.
So one final question. We didn't talk about this topic, but I'm just kind of curious because we seem like we talk about it all the time in so many other cancers, which is the use of PARP inhibitors in pancreatic cancer. I haven't seen anything particularly exciting or new in that arena, but I'm just curious right now because I feel like we're talking about it all the time in, you know, breast, prostate, and of course, ovarian. I'm curious right now how you're approaching the use of PARP inhibitors in pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, so I have a number of patients under my care as we speak who have BRCA1 or 2, many 2 mutations. And my approach is very simple. I start off with a platinum-based treatment. And I'm saying it platinum-based for a reason, which I'll come in a second. And the platinum-based treatment, at least 4 months, they have at least stable disease. In those patients, I will go for a PARP inhibitor, which is olaparib, which is one I have access to. There are also some clinical trials out there, and there is one which is being done by SWOG, and I'm part of it, which is olaparib plus minus pembrolizumab in patients who are. And there's also a study which is being done by Alliance, and it's a chemotherapy, whether adjuvant or perioperative, in resectable disease, and if they are BRCA positive, then they go on a PARP inhibitor, olaparib again in this situation. So this is really what I do. When I say platinum-based treatment, because sometimes you see patients whose bilirubin is stuck at a 3 or a 4 or something, and you can't give them FOLFIRINOX for the reasons I gave you earlier. In those patients, I use gemcitabine and cisplatin. And I see good results with it. In fact, gemcitabine, I think, is a very good combination for patients with BRCA mutation. So that's my the way I'm doing it. And I continue on the PARP inhibitor for as long as their disease is controlled. And then when they get progression, obviously we change.
Yeah, you know, that adjuvant study is very interesting. You know, I can imagine having a BRCA, you know, BRCA germline patient. And that's, you know, even in, you know, borderline resectable, it must be tempting to want to use a PARP inhibitor. I understand the logic of the trial, but it seems compelling that it's such a desperate situation. If a patient said to you, I don't want to go in the trial, will you give me a PARP inhibitor, would you do it?
So we're talking about someone who goes through resection and gets chemo before or after or whatever.
Right.
I had to make a recommendation on a patient, an international patient, 6-7 months ago, and my recommendation was to take it. And I tell you what, Neil, I mean, think about it. I mean, God forbid if I'm the patient. I mean, those patients, they don't get cured, right? So I would do anything possible. Yes, I would recommend it to a patient in a situation like that. I personally would recommend it.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Philip, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.